From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the governor signs a new education budget with money going to private schools. Does that make the school budget unconstitutional? Plus, just when did Michigan's former chief medical officer really know about the Legionnaires outbreak in Genesee County?
This is the first time that we see that Dr. Davis is on an email.
Michigan toughened up its teacher certification test, but has the pendulum swung too far?
You don't want a test that sees whether people can get the answer. You want a test that inspects whether a teacher candidate can explain ideas.
And Tiger fans, remember the bird.
Groomed the mound with his hands, the dirt in his hands, talked to the baseball. He finished his games in 2 hours. They go twice as long now. Bird was awesome.
From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's most recent version of teacher certification test includes some pretty tough questions, but are they asking the right things?
You don't want a test that sees whether people can get the answer. You want a test that inspects whether a teacher candidate can explain ideas.
Examining Michigan's teacher certification test, that comes up later this hour. But first, he was Michigan's chief medical executive at the time of the outbreak of Legionnaires' disease in Genesee County. The outbreak killed 12 people. He also served on Governor Snyder's Flint Water Task Force. But Dr. Matthew Davis says he never learned of the Legionnaires' outbreak before leaving his state post in April 2015. Here's Dr. Davis speaking with Lester Graham on Stateside this past March.
Do you think it was appropriate for you to be sitting on this task force since you might have had a role in some of the decisions at Health and Human Services?
So there are two parts to your question. One is, was I aware of the Legionnaires' cases? And unfortunately, I was not aware of the Legionnaires' cases.
But among the 303,000 pages of documents about Flint water released last week by the Snyder administration was an email that casts that claim into some doubt. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News Lansing Bureau is with us now. Chad, what's in this email?
Well, Cindy, there was an email sent on January 28, 2015, by the head of the Communicable Disease Division to some higher-ups at the Department of Health in the state government. And one of the recipients was Dr. Matthew Davis, along with the chief deputy director of the health department, Tim Becker, another deputy director, Susan Moran, and the state epidemiologist, Corinne Miller. And this email laid out how there was some concerns that these elevated levels of Legionella infection within Genesee County may be connected to the Flint River water. Dr. Davis never replied to this email, but he was a recipient on a string of emails where this was being discussed among these top officials of the Department of Health and Human Services in Michigan.
How does this fit into what we know about the way the state and Genesee County responded to those reports of Legionnaires outbreaks? As we know, we had the first wave in 2014 and then that second wave in 2015.
Well, this email is kind of the first documentation showing the earliest date when high-level officials in the state health department were made aware of this outbreak, at least in email communication. There's obviously all kinds of ways for people to communicate in person, over the phone, text message. And those are some of the things that the Attorney General's office was looking into in their wide-ranging probe of the Flint water crisis. But this email establishes at the time, and some other records established, that sometime around this date, they went to the department director, Nick Lyon, and then Nick went back and basically asked Genesee County to kind of step up its investigation because there was a very slow, sluggish investigation. There was some internal and bureaucratic squabbling between the state and the county health department over how they were handling it. This Jim Collins, who kind of handles, oversees these things, at one point he kind of stepped in and instructed the county, you know, they need to run communication to the CDC through him. There was some lines drawn in the bureaucracy of the multiple agencies involved here. And this all kind of came out in some of these records that were released last week, some of them we received back in February when Genesee County released 14,000 pages of emails. But, yeah, this is the first time that we see that Dr. Davis is on an email. And his response to me was, well, I wasn't asked for input on discussions regarding the Flint water situation, which is a little different, nuanced response to his original comments to us and to Lester Graham that he was never made aware of the Legionella outbreak.
In fact, we reached out to Dr. Davis today, and he wrote us back to say that he's seeing patients today. He's unavailable tomorrow. So I'm going to hearken back to that interview last March with Lester Graham. And here's what Dr. Davis said about what he knew and when.
I was not a part of these decisions about Legionnaire's disease or lead. I actually would be happy to provide emails because there aren't any.
So what do you think hearing that?
Well, maybe he thinks he didn't get it. Maybe it's possible that he never got the email. I mean, that's a defense that's been used a couple times already in the Flint water crisis and in assessing what various officials from the governor's office down knew and when about the timeline of events. But the one little context, there's been so many email dumps since February, well over 500,000 pages of records, if not more, have come out of state government agencies. This cache of 9,000 pages from the Health and Human Services Department is really the first significant amount of records out of that department. They are literally the last frontier in this whole effort by the Snyder administration to open up its books and let everyone know. We've seen Governor Snyder's emails. We've been seeing these for months now. But for whatever reason, the health department has been the slowest to give out its emails related to this Legionnaires outbreak, which is kind of a side subject to the greater issue of the lead poisoning that went on in the water in Flint.
You know, Chad, we've heard this kind of thing through all these releases of emails regarding Flint water. Is there any sense that there were just so many thousands of emails flying all over the place that, you know, stuff didn't get seen or it got seen and it didn't register because of all the emails? Or are people not being forthright?
I can't really give a full assessment of that. I do know over the context, the winter of 2015, the Departments of Community Health and the Health and Human Services were undergoing a massive merger. This was under Governor Snyder's, quote, River of Opportunity initiative to try to streamline and make these two big agencies one ginormous agency and make it more streamlined services for people, for health and for the welfare end of state government. And so, part of the whole story of this entire debacle is people kind of pushed other people off and no one sort of connected the dots as this thing was developing. But these early warning signs at the top levels of the Health and Human Services Department came well before the outbreak ended and literally, as lives were still being lost.
Chad Livengood, Detroit News Lansing Bureau. Chad, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Governor Snyder today signed the new $16 billion state education budget. It has a 2% boost over last year's school budget, and it has something else, $2.5 million of public money going to private and parochial schools. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here now to explain. Rick, what's this $2.5 million for private schools going for?
Well, you know, and we should point out that this $2.5 million is minuscule when you think of it in the context of the entire like $30 billion state budget. But it does put the camel's nose under the tent of giving some sort of state support, public money, to these private and parochial schools. This money would be used to pay for things that the state mandates, like fire drills, for example. And so it's just a little bit, given that way. However, the sponsor of this idea, the ardently pro-school choice advocate, chair of the House Education Budget Subcommittee, Tim Kelly, he acknowledges it's precedent setting. He hopes it's just the beginning.
I think we need to let parents decide the best education for their kids, regardless of where that is and regardless of what setting that is.
So this basically gets us right back into that vouchers discussion, using state money for private and parochial schools. Voters have rejected this approach at least twice in the 1970s and the 1990s. And so what we're seeing here is actually an effort to kind of push the boundaries and see how far we can take it. And even Governor Snyder, who signed this, the whole thing, there are no vetoes in this budget, said that part, that's questionable.
There are potentially some legal issues, and we're still looking at the consequences and the best way to address some of the legal issues associated with that. But at this point, I thought it appropriate to move ahead and let's address the legal questions separately.
So we've heard this before. We're going to push something through and then come back and fix it in post-production, as they say.
in the broadcasting biz.
Yeah.
And I think there is a question, that now that the governor has signed this budget, if his office sort of unilaterally determines that it's not in compliance with the state constitution, well, What does he do then? Now, I guess they don't have to mail the checks, but if it's already in state law, then you could see the schools lining up and knocking on the door and going, you know, where is our money?
Or could a challenge completely torpedo the entire if there's a constitutional challenge, could it completely torpedo the entire school budget?
The governor says no, that they've accounted for that and so that this is severable from the rest of the budget. And I think we can expect organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union at least to file some kind of a legal challenge to this. Because I would like to – now, I know that reading from the state constitution is not typically scintillating radio.
Yeah, but this is – help us understand this controversy.
But this is – I mean the state constitution is pretty emphatic in this regard. Here's what it says, just in part, and I'm picking from it. No public monies or property shall be appropriated or paid or any public credit utilized by the legislature or any other political subdivision or agency of the state directly or indirectly to aid or maintain any private, denominational, or other non-public, pre-elementary, elementary, or second school. And it goes on to say no payment, credit, tax benefit, exemption, deductions, tuition vouchers, subsidy, grant, loan of public monies, or property shall be provided directly or indirectly. I mean, they just list it out, you know,
yeah,
specifically and emphatically. And
yet so he signed it.
And we will see what happens with this language.
Yet he signed it.
He did.
Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief. As always, thanks, Rick.
Always a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaboration.
Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
Opining about the millennial generation has become almost a sport nowadays. But Jeff DeGraff, our partner on The Next Idea, looks at the shift in social values in America and sees lasting innovation. In his latest commentary, Jeff wonders whether this widening generation gap means we're approaching the death of marriage, capitalism, and God.
The next big thing isn't a clever gadget or a miracle drug. It's a way of life. Not a breakthrough invention, but a social innovation. Rising numbers of young people are now deciding to do everything their parents didn't. They're eschewing cultural and economic convention to challenge what we take to be civil society. They aren't marrying. They become the refuseniks of our competitive corporate culture. And many of them have opted out of organized religion altogether. Let's start with a quick look at some facts. The end of marriage. According to the New York Times, over half of all American women under the age of 30 who gave birth are unmarried. When adjusted for levels of education and economics, the numbers skew dramatically higher. Of course, there's an array of possible causes to this trend, including everything from the relative economic independence of educated women, to the shift away from the cultural stigma of unwed parentage, to even a latent reaction to the divorce of their own parents. This change brings a complex array of challenges. For example, marriage is a foundational element of our legal system connected to property, beneficiary, and custodial rights and obligations. Scandinavian countries with the same downward trend for marriage among the young rank among the highest educated in the world with a standard of living positioned well atop our own. The end of capitalism. Well before the collapse of the middle-class economy in America, Europe, and now Asia, young people started cultural movements that shifted the center of balance from economics to social values. According to Pew Research, this change is creating an enormous generation gap between boomers and millennials that's still widening. It's likely a response to the worst employment prospects for young adults in almost a century, and a renewal of idealistic frontierism, with the new urban corridor as the 21st century Wild West. What were once areas of blight are now shining lights for our youth. Brooklyn, Cleveland, and Detroit come to mind. Signs of the new anti-commercialism are everywhere. Shared houses and cars, urban farm collectives, and the end of intellectual property rights. There's a noticeable shift away from traditional careers. Instead, many lean towards value-centric goals of communal harmony. The end of God. According to the Washington Post, 25% of millennials don't affiliate with a faith-based tradition, and almost twice as many don't belong to a church. More so, another Pew Research study suggests that an astonishing low number of young people believe in the existence of a God. As religious participation, affiliation, and even belief wane in post-Christian Europe and the Americas, atheism is now among the fastest-growing affiliation among young adults. It seems like some have turned an anti-faith into its own kind of faith. So why is this happening, and what does this mean? Many sociologists suggest that this transition is merely the 21st century version of the same irrational exuberance we saw in the late 1920s and the 1960s. They often frame these transitions as the adolescent stage of a grand cycle of divergence and convergence. This explanation implies that we should just let the cycle run its course and things will return to normal. In reality, though, boundless connectivity has changed the way we integrate our experiences with our interpretation of those experiences. It's created a whole new type of normal. The idea of a grand worldview that we all share has been replaced by a wide range of personalized worldviews. We have become a collective me. Is this the end of marriage, capitalism, and God? Yes and no. Our pieces are now our wholeness. Marriage, capitalism, and God will persist, but they'll reappear in new guises. Grand forces on a more personalized, intimate scale. The key concept here is hybrids, mixtures of old institutions and innovative new ways. The institutions that formerly served as bridges for diverse people with varied views are now impassable and separate us. Our young people are simply finding their own way to bring us back together.
Jeff DeGraff is a clinical professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and our partner on The Next Idea. Views expressed in Jeff's essay are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Michigan Radio, its management, or the station licensee, the University of Michigan.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A nonprofit group out of Ann Arbor is winning international praise for the way it's helping some of the world's poorest people. The Appropriate Technology Collaborative has been named among the world's top 100 leaders in global sustainability, honored by Sustainia for a project that's changing lives in rural Guatemala. With us is the founder and the executive director of the Appropriate Technology Collaborative, John Barry. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Cindy.
ATC recently named one of the global leaders in sustainable solutions. Tell us about the project in Guatemala that really drew this praise. It's Mayan Power and Light Project.
Yeah, Mayan Power and Light is a project, a program, where we teach Mayan women, rural Mayan women, about electricity, circuits, and solar power. We then teach them how to install solar power and also work on basic construction skills so that they can get up on the roof and actually install solar panels and then wire them together with the proper pieces of technology to make the whole system work. And then installing light switches, and whatever is necessary to get a complete solar power system installed. They're better than I am at this.
They've gotten good.
They really have. Well, our Guatemalan team teaches the classes and teaches the solar power projects. I am the executive director of the nonprofit, and I've helped set up the program. But really, we have this wonderful staff in Guatemala that is capable of teaching these classes and also helping with business development.
What put this on your radar screen in the first place?
Well, we've been designing technologies for low-income people for 10 years now. And some things we've put online and had great success. We designed a solar vaccine refrigerator that you can build anywhere in the world out of locally available parts. It doesn't use electricity of any kind. You just put it in the sun, and it freezes things. It's very simple technology. We don't break any of the laws of thermodynamics. And so we were designing technologies like that and putting them online, and people were copying them and building them. And that was very rewarding. But we don't have any real documentation of the impact of that. So we decided to start programs. And some technologies need a program. They need a business model to get into people's hands.
And this did it.
Oh, Mayan Power and Light, the business works really well. We're primarily providing light where no light is.
And I'm wondering, have you been there in the villages to see what it's done? What's that like?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, people can volunteer with us and join us to do this type of project. You can work with our women in Guatemala, and they'll teach you how to install solar power. Anyway, so I've been there many times, and turning on the light switch for the first time is an amazing effect. Oftentimes, everybody in the village will come to if we've put power on a village community center, this is the first time they can actually meet at night in the community center. And when we throw the switch, everybody in the village might come and to see that happen. And it's a great celebration.
It has to be incredibly, incredibly powerful for your volunteers to be able to bring some of what we take for granted here and bring that into people's lives.
Yes. We're working with people, families that have no electricity, so they use candles or kerosene lamps to see at night. And they're living, cooking on the floor of their kitchens. This is like living in the Middle Ages. And with just a few watts of solar power, they can have electric lights that are very bright. They can see at night for the first time. And the women do weaving. The men often work fixing things around the house. And the kids do their homework at night for the first time. This is a family getting out of poverty in one generation because they got one light bulb that works. The other energy we provide is a USB outlet for charging a cell phone. Everybody has a cell phone in the world. There's more cell phones than people. And in Guatemala, when you don't have electricity and you have a cell phone, oftentimes you have to charge your phone. You hike 90 minutes to the nearest outlet. You wait for a few hours while it charges. And then you hike back to your house. And you lose almost a full day's work.
I'm curious how a guy in Ann Arbor, you, became so aware of what the situation was like for these Mayan people.
Well, I actually started out on a trip to Ecuador. I was traveling through rural Ecuador, and I noticed that people, this is very high up in the mountains, during the day, they were baking. They were sunburned up at 10,000, 12,000 feet. And at night, it's so cold that you can get frost on the underside of a roof. And I thought, as an architect, I know how to design passive solar buildings. I could take the same materials, the same windows, doors, the same square footage of concrete, the same walls, but rearrange them in such a way that the building would be naturally cool during the day and warm at night without costing a nickel more.
A great use of your architect's training.
And then I realized there's lots of things that we could design that would improve the quality of life for the world's poorest people.
And actually, ATC is involved not only in Guatemala.
We also have had projects in India and in Nicaragua. And then through our internet connections, we have people who have picked up our drawings from different technologies in 43 different countries.
Well, congratulations on the work. What's next? What do you want to do next?
I want to do several things next. I think we need to, in Guatemala, increase the number of programs that provide an income for people. I talked about the value of what people are selling, but there's also other ways of getting income into people's hands. It's a very poor country. We're looking forward to working with people who sort garbage in the Guatemala City dump. We're going to work with them to sort plastics and then recycle the plastics essentially on site, right next to the Guatemala City dump. We're going to be taking two different types of plastics and then doing injection molding with those to make new products that we can sell all over the world.
Using technology to do good. We want to congratulate you, John Barry, founder, executive director of Ann Arbor-based Appropriate Technology Collaborative. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks. It's been fun.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. A lot of trading and drafting and old-fashioned wheeling and dealing that's been going on, both in hockey and basketball. First, let's go to the NHL and break it down for us, John. Exactly what happened between Detroit and Arizona with Pavel Datsyuk's salary cap?
It's almost impossible to explain, Cindy, so I'll try to make it as simple as I can. Datsyuk does not want to play in Detroit. He wants to go back to Russia, which you think, okay, no big deal. But the Wings are stuck with $7.5 million of his salary cap salary, even though they're not going to pay him because this is the NHL is all I can tell you.
So what did each side get?
The main thing the Wings got is unloading a $7.5 million burden under the salary cap. So now they've got $7.5 million to play with to get somebody big like, say, Stamkos from the Tampa Bay Lightning. What Arizona got was a couple of things. One is the chance, albeit slim, I think, of getting Datsyuk to play in Arizona. Two, they flip-flopped with Detroit a first-round 16th pick for a 20th pick. So Detroit goes from 16 to 20. Arizona goes from 20 to 16. Frankly, it's nothing. But it's a big deal to Detroit. Detroit got the better deal here. And now they can look to the future and possibly get a guy like Stamkos, the star of Tampa Bay. You might have seen him beat up on Detroit the last two playoffs.
Yeah.
And they need somebody like that. And keep in mind, too, it's crucial they not fold to now. Why? Because in the fall of 2017, they opened a new stadium. You can't open a new stadium with a crappy team. So they have got to gear up, get whatever they can get, max out the salary cap and all that, and they're going to go all in right now.
So let's pivot over to the NBA draft, and I'm interested in your thoughts on the draft results for some pretty big names in college athletics in this state. Wondering how you'd grade the moves for the player and the team, starting with MSU's Denzel Valentine going to Chicago in the 14th overall pick.
By all accounts, a great guy, one of Izzo's favorite players of all time, which is saying a lot. He was supposed to go lower than his teammate Deonta Davis, who is a freshman, a one-and-done guy. And in fact, the NBA flipped this around, so you never know what's going to happen until they start picking you. And for Denzel, it's a great move. For Chicago, I think it's a very good move. Slight injury risk, but I think that's negligible given what you what the upside is.
And for Deonta Davis, that one and done, he had to sit there and sit there and sit there before going in the second round, getting picked by Boston, who are packing him off to Memphis.
That's right. That's how it goes, right? Boston picks you, and you end up in Memphis somehow. But Tom Izzo, their coach, sat next to him near the end of that because he was getting so dejected. There are only two rounds in the NBA draft, and this might be a cautionary tale. For all those players who want to leave early, it might not always be the best idea.
How about Caris LeVert from Michigan? He missed those 14 games with a broken foot, but went to the Brooklyn Nets, number 20?
A bit of a miracle, really, because he's had so many problems with his left foot. He wrote a wonderful letter, by the way, about how difficult it was to grow up without his dad and fight these injuries. And I think it had an actually very positive effect. We might be seeing more letters in newspapers from players in the future.
Should also tip the hat to Oakland's Kay Felder, who's a junior getting picked by the Cavaliers, 54th overall.
This guy is 5'9", Cindy. I am 5'8". The Cavaliers are not calling me currently for this or anything else. This guy also has the second best all-time NBA combine jump of 44 vertical inches. So 5'9", how to get drafted? You can jump almost 4 feet.
Finally, we have to note a moment in sports history. Veterans, Tigers fans are going to find this very hard to believe. It's 40 years ago tomorrow that America tuned into ABC's Monday Night Baseball and met Tigers rookie pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich.
I was an 11-year-old kid, one of the greatest summers of my life. I will not forget that as long as I live. You watched it yourself, I believe.
Uh-huh.
It's when Bird went national, and it didn't change him at all. Still getting on his hands and knees to groom the mound with his hands, the dirt in his hands, talk to the baseball, run around the infield after a good play, cheering on his teammates. They loved playing for the guy. He finished his games in 2 hours. They go twice as long now. Bird was awesome.
He filled stadiums. He won. He was endearing. And then a year later, it's all over.
It is, pretty much.
What
happened? He dragged it out, but very quirky. In spring training, he's shagging fly balls, which means screwing around in the outfield during practice, and tore his knee. Now, once you tear your knee, you think, okay, that's a knee problem, not an arm problem. But then you come back too soon, and you change your delivery, and now you've got an arm problem because you're not throwing the ball the same way. So his career was never the same. But one glorious summer that we will never forget, and the guy was so cool, and he was cool to the day he died. He never changed.
Yes, in fact, that was April 2009, that tragic accident on his farm. But yeah, a very big moment for Tiger fans in their history.
Absolutely.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. It wasn't that long ago that serious questions were being raised about just how well Michigan's education schools were preparing their students to be teachers. Critics pointed to the teacher certification test. The pass rate then was about 82% statewide. Prospective teachers were passing their exams at the same level as people seeking a cosmetology license. So the state heard the critics and toughened up the teacher prep and certification process. Now there's a new issue. How many would-be teachers in Michigan are not passing the tougher new certification test? Have we gone too far? With us is Deborah Ball, Dean of the School of Education at the University of Michigan.
Great to be with you, Cynthia.
We welcome Maddie Steinbaugh. Maddie is a student from Michigan State University's School of Education. She took the MTTC, the Michigan Test for Teacher Certification, and then didn't pass. Maddie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me today.
Deborah, in a state where standardized test scores, our student scores, are often in the bottom half of the states and sliding south, how important was it to toughen up the teacher preparation and certification process?
It's very important to have strict tests to determine whether somebody is ready to be a teacher. The problem is that what the public thinks and what many states have done, and probably Michigan as well, is to test things that are not the relevant content or skills that people need to teach. We're creating kind of a false threshold or barrier to get people into teaching. And this is very serious because we actually need very good teachers. And if we test on things that are not the important kinds of skills and knowledge that they need, then we're going to artificially exclude people from the profession at a time when we most need really skilled teachers.
So get us all on the same page. So what do students like Maddie need to do before they can be certified to step in front of a classroom in Michigan?
In most cases, students complete a program that's been approved by the state, which means the state inspects the curriculum of the program to determine that certain kinds of courses are offered, including in the arts and sciences. So that would cover the disciplinary knowledge preparation. They don't actually inspect the students themselves. We don't actually have a test that looks at whether people can explain content to children, whether they can manage a classroom, whether they can talk sensibly with parents. And that is the direction that the profession is seeking to head, to assess people on the actual skills that they need to be good beginning teachers. And we see that in other occupations and professions, that what it takes to be licensed in a field is to be pass a set of assessments that assess your capability for that particular occupation or profession.
So the old basic skills test, out with that. And now what's there? I mean, Maddie took the Michigan test for teacher certification. Is that the main one? Are there other ones?
We have a couple of different tests with different names, but they primarily are testing content knowledge. Now, that would sound to most people listening that, of course, we would want teachers to know content. The issue is that the way in which teachers need to understand content to teach is quite different than what most people automatically assume. The kinds of things that teachers need to know, the average person on the street would never pass. A teacher needs to be able to explain, for example, when you divide 1 3/4 divided by 1/2, most people know how to do that. You convert 1 3/4 to 7/4. You flip the 1/2. You multiply effectively 7/4 times 2/1. And lo and behold, you get 3.5. The first time a fourth grader says to you, like, why is the answer 1 3/4 divided by 1/2, 3.5? Like, that answer is bigger than what we started with. You're in deep trouble. So you don't want a test that sees whether people can get the answer. You want a test that inspects whether a teacher candidate can explain ideas. Can they explain how you find the main idea of a story? Can they explain what you do when you encounter a word that you don't know? What are the skills that good readers bring? What is it that children do as they learn to read? And the simplest tests to produce are ones that test basic skills content. And the test questions themselves, if any listeners have tried to take them, are really quite not at all like what you'd expect somebody to be able to do in order to teach.
Maddie Steinbaugh, how did your coursework go?
This past semester, I finished with a 3.6. I finished all the classes needed until I can take the final chunk of the teaching classes that are needed. But in order to take those, I have to pass the MTTC, the PRE right now. And I've taken that actually 9 times, and each time the outcome is a little bit different. But I did just recently get scores from my previous exam, and a minimum passing score would be a 220, and I got a 207, so that was actually one of the higher scores that I've received, but not what's needed to pass.
You've taken it 9 times.
Yes.
When you sat down that first time, Maddie, did you feel prepared? Were you kind of in your mind saying, okay, I'm ready, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, and the first time I ever took it, I did not prepare for it because I kind of wanted to get a feel of what it was for, what it was about, and I wasn't totally prepared that I was supposed to take it. So it was just kind of thrown at me, and I went in and took it. But each time I've worked with tutors, I've gotten a blue grammar book before, I did all the coursework for OWL, and I just ordered these flashcards that I knew nothing about that hopefully will give me some extra knowledge.
What are you hearing from classmates? Are other people in your program having the same problem tackling this test?
Yes, I have a handful of friends, actually, who have not scored as high as I have, but they have taken it so many times. And it's starting to become where kids are questioning, do I really want to be a teacher? Because this test is kind of proving that I'm not smart enough, or I don't have what it takes to be a teacher. And I have friends who have changed their major completely because they were just burnt out. And I've questioned my teaching so much, but I have my mom and my friends who tell me I cannot give up because I was born to be a teacher, and I totally agree with them. So at this point, I'm putting all the power I can in to pass this exam.
Deborah Ball, are we seeing stories like Maddie's happening throughout the state?
I think that we are, and I think that this will be a difficult topic for the public to understand because teaching is a very skillful profession. It requires a lot of knowledge and skill. And though I believe, Maddie, that you were born to be a teacher, what I hear when I hear you say that is that you're a person who has a deep commitment to learning to be a good teacher, but teaching is actually something people have to learn to do. So you do want there to be stringent, tough exams for people to pass in order to become teachers. But the devil is in the details here. The test needs to be tough about things that are relevant to teaching and predictive of whether someone will be a good teacher. Just hearing the word tough will make the public think like good. We're becoming really stringent about what the requirements are to become a teacher. But in fact, the kinds of tests that we need in order to choose who's ready to enter a classroom should be testing something quite different than what most states, including Michigan, test in order to determine whether someone should become a licensed teacher.
So this is, I believe I hear you say, Deborah, this is a bad test for what you need to test for. This is not the one. This isn't doing it.
I'm not going to go so far as to say whether it's good or bad, but what I am going to say is that it's crucial to be testing the kinds of knowledge and skills that candidates need in order to be allowed to teach children. Mm-hmm. This is our society's most important job. So when somebody like Maddie and her colleagues decide to become teachers, they go to excellent programs. She's in one of the best teacher education programs in the country. And as she moves through that, it's appropriate that she pass an exam. But the exam she should pass should require her to do things like explain an idea in a way that a child could understand. That shows that she knows content, and it shows that she knows how to explain something in a way that a child could understand it. She should show that she knows how to lead a discussion among a small group of children about a story or about a math problem. She should show that she knows how to choose a good example when she's beginning to explain something. And the tests that most people are having to pass don't test anything like that.
And
for example, a math test might test the kind of content taught in university mathematics courses, and that content is not the content that Maddie is going to be teaching to children. She needs to pass a math test in which she shows that she understands why multiplication works the way it does, why you would explain the way that we carry or borrow, which is the old-fashioned term, in a math problem. She needs to be able to explain how you decode words or how you comprehend text. But a test that just measures her on sort of high-level academic content with questions that are not actually relevant to the sorts of things that she's going to be doing as a teacher doesn't help us to predict whether she's done the preparation she needs in order to become a teacher.
Who gave us the PRE? Where did Michigan get it? And who decided that this is what we need to raise the bar on teacher certification processes in our state?
There's a long history of teacher certification exams testing what people call basic skills content. Mm-hmm. When people hear that, they think of something very simple, like third grade content. That's not what these tests are about. Now, teachers do need to know content, but they need to know content in ways that are actually much deeper and more flexible than the way the average person in the public knows. And I know Maddie could speak to that. And they also need to know quite a lot of other things. And some of the things we should be testing are not paper-pencil items. Mm. They should be performances of different kinds. We at the University of Michigan have been working on developing a set of new performance assessments for teaching we think will predict much better whether someone is ready for the classroom. And in fact, we should put much more of our effort in assessing teacher candidates like Maddie at the point that they're ready to become licensed teachers after they've completed their programs, before they're entitled to begin teaching. I should add that we have a 40% dip around the country, including in Michigan, of people interested in going into teaching, which is nothing less than a societal crisis.
And when you hear the likes of Maddie saying, she and some of her other friends are saying, are we meant to do this? We're burning out on this.
Every time in our history as a nation, when we have had a shortage of teachers, we suddenly get desperate and we admit basically anybody off the street who's willing to teach. Mm-hmm. That's not who Maddie is. Maddie is somebody who has spent time learning the kinds of skills she needs to teach, learning content in a way that she could explain it to children, learning how to diagnose whether children really understand things, learning how to give assessments, learning how to manage a classroom. And what she's telling us is that the test she's taken is not relevant to the kind of professional skills that she's been acquiring, and now she's becoming discouraged about entering the profession. We can't go through a period in the next 5 to 10 years in Michigan in which we don't have well-prepared teachers ready to enter the classroom. It's crucial that the assessments we use are aligned with the professional capabilities that we need a first-year teacher to have.
Maddie, what do you think you would bring to the classroom as a teacher?
I'd be working with kids with disabilities, and to me, I look right through all of those disabilities, and kids are all kids to me, whether they are autistic, have Down syndrome, are bright, it doesn't matter to me, and I am invested with kids, so I couldn't really imagine my career path not with kids, and as much as I like to teach them, they also teach me lessons as well.
What options now? You've taken this PRE 9 times.
Yeah.
Where do you go from here? What do you think you'll do?
Well, I am being told that I cannot give up on teaching. That is something that's not allowed to go away from me. And at this point, since I've worked so hard, I don't want to see myself give up. And I'm hoping that I can find the way to pass because I want to be a teacher. I don't want to sit in an office. I want to be with kids because kids are my life.
Could she go out of Michigan, Deborah? And again, this is into things that the public, you know, we civilians don't understand.
Each state licenses teachers, so it's a state-regulated system. The states have very similar kinds of assessments, although there is variation across states. So if Maddie were to move, she would have to pass the licensure requirements in another state. She might even find that she needs to take a few state-specific things like history of that state. But I do want to emphasize that in many cities, particularly in places where we have the lowest income students and students of color, we have people who are allowed to begin teaching who haven't done any of the preparation that Maddie has done nor passed any kind of exam. I want to emphasize again that we want professional preparation of the kind that Maddie's been committing herself to get so that she can teach special education students. And then we do need an assessment to ensure that they've not just passed their classes, but have the capability of actually working with students to do the things that Maddie says she dreams of doing.
And to your point, Deborah, we should point out here that the Detroit Public School Rescue Package that the Republicans in Michigan's House have put together includes allowing uncertified teachers to teach in Detroit. So it sounds like it's let's raise the standards and toughen up the tests. You wind up stranding students like Maddie unless they're willing to teach in Detroit. What does all of that say to you, Deborah?
No, there's a definite kind of dilemma going on right now where on one hand we have severe shortages in some of our highest needs communities, and then we have tests that aren't actually allowing us to determine who has prepared enough to be allowed to begin teaching and who should not. In any occupation and profession, we don't let people just complete programs and then walk into the job. Not cosmetologists that you mentioned before, but not nurses, not people in any profession, not plumbers. Any profession or occupation you can name, people actually have to demonstrate that they have the skills. You don't have these circuitous pathways in these other fields where you can just walk into being a nurse because you decided not to become prepared. So I think it's crucial that we have pathways where people get professional training and that there be tests that are rigorous. The rigor has to be about the professional demands of the work and not about something extraneous.
Do we have any idea the statewide pass rate now that the new test, the PRE, is in? Are we seeing a precipitous decline from what we had under the old test?
We definitely have seen a decline, and I do want to emphasize that given what the content of the test is, that's not terribly surprising because it's testing academic content at a level that's not necessarily at all aligned with the content that people will be teaching, as though somehow that were the minimum level, and then after that we will test their professional skills. I think that for this argument to be had in a sensible way in the public, we should get a little bit more into the detail about exactly what it is that's being tested so that the public can understand that when they hear basic skills, they should not be imagining a test that looks like second graders pass.
What needs to happen in our state so that we're not losing good candidates for our teacher positions?
The United States has a system in which each state determines what it takes to become a teacher. That's part of our whole local control system. So there are tests available in the country that are being developed that provide some alternatives of what might be required of a candidate to demonstrate before he or she earns a license. However, Michigan, like many states, seeks to get a test developed specifically for that state. It would be more sensible to consider this to be a profession in which you would expect to see well-developed tests that can be used across states be the requirement that someone has to pass. What it takes to build the sort of professional performance exams that we've been building at the University of Michigan, not for our program, but for use in the profession, takes a lot of expertise, money, field trials, measurement, testing to see whether the test is actually valid. It's not reasonable to expect each state to build its own tailored test. So it would require a shift in perspective that it would make sense to a Department of Education like our own agency that they would choose from the available professional exams that are being prepared in this country and not think that each one needs to be specific to that state.
And then meantime, for Maddie and others like her through Michigan who are kind of left holding the bag trying to make this happen, I don't know what the answer is.
The most important thing to understand is that the test should be rigorous. It should distinguish between people who are ready to take on the responsibilities of children's learning and those who are not. But it should test things that are directly relevant to their ability to be skillful first and second year teachers.
Maddie, you going to keep taking the test?
I'm going to, because this is what I want to go into, and I'm going to do what it takes to prove that I'm qualified to be a teacher.
Maddie Steinbaugh is an education student at Michigan State University, and Deborah Ball is dean of the College of Education at the University of Michigan. Thank you to both of you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you always, Cynthia.
Thank you so much.
And finally, you may have heard about some U.S. Supreme Court decisions with national implications that were handed down today, but there was one Michigan-centric decision the cable news pundits might not have picked up on. The nation's highest court denied a request by former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick for an appeal of his 2013 corruption conviction. The court denied the request without comment. Kilpatrick is serving a 28-year prison sentence. The former mayor of Detroit is set to be released in August of 2037. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.